Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, millions of Americans paid tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. In San Francisco, many from the local faith communities demonstrated in front of the Federal Reserve Bank to highlight the growing gap between the rich and the poor. In New York, protesters highlighted Dr. King's focus on poverty. 44 years after Dr. King was assassinated, 40 million Americans are living in poverty, and 50 million are without health insurance. A recent survey by the Pew Research Center shows that a rising share of Americans see conflict between the rich and the poor. The survey found that over the past 3 years, more traditional sources of friction, race, gender, religion, sexual preference, age, and national origin, have become vastly overshadowed by distrust over wealth. And the biggest jump in class awareness has occurred among white independents. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on how the changing realities of our economy affect class and racial divides. What does the income gap tell us about what has or has not changed since Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in 1963? Dr. Clarence Jones worked on a draft of the I Have a Dream speech. He was an attorney for Dr. King. Clarence Jones is a scholar in residence and visiting professor at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. He also writes for the Huffington Post, and he's author of the book Behind the Dream, the making of the speech that transformed a nation. Hi, Dr. Jones. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thank you for joining us. So I'd like to start off by asking you to really reflect back on a specific passage of this speech in 1963. And Dr. King said, quote, "In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing
a promissory note.
Right. And he said this note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, and I'm sure he might include women today, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why don't you reflect back on that specific passage?
What, I'm sorry, why did you say that?
Would you reflect back on that passage?
Well, I can certainly reflect back on that passage. That's part of the textual language that I had suggested that he consider using. And little did I know until I heard him speak that, in fact, he would use it. It was a reflection of his belief and our joint belief and the belief of several of his advisors, particularly Stanley Levison and I, who worked very closely with Dr. King, that in 1963, certainly then, and even to some extent today, is that the condition of the African Americans in the United States, particularly their economic condition, is a consequence of the legacy of slavery. And the legacy of slavery has had profound economic consequences on African Americans as descendants of the former slaves. One of the things that is not spelled out in that passage, but conceptually, was part of the concept underlying that passage, is that after emancipation, is that there was a moral, political, and economic obligation on the part of the government to provide some economic financial base for 4 million newly emancipated slaves. And that attempt was initially reflected in something called the Freedmen's Bureau, which the concept was set up that a Freedmen's Bureau would take 40 acres of plantation land that had been seized by plantation owners in the Confederate States, and each slave would get 40 acres and a mule in order to give them some economic base. Well, the broadcast is too short for me to go into the details. That never happened, and so forth. But the concept underlying that passage in the I Have a Dream simply is that African Americans, descendants of African Americans, were the only group in America whose ancestors were enslaved and for whom there was no economic foundation of wealth or capital that could be transferred from generation to generation. And in 1863, as still today, one of the prime forms of capital, of economic sustenance, is land. And the means of production, of course, the mule was the means of production. But my point is that there was no wealth. There was no accumulated wealth. There was no economic sustenance transferred from one generation of African Americans to another generation, and might I add, with compound interest. And so that it's not surprising that African Americans would be in a disadvantaged position. Now this gets us. Lynn, leave that here. They're over there. This gets us into a controversial concept, which is also underlying that speech. So that concept is called reparations, and his form of reparations is that we can't believe that this nation, as rich as it is, who has issued a promissory note, that promissory, and we came to Washington to tell the country we're here to collect on that promissory note, which is payable on demand. And so we're demanding that it be paid. And we can't believe that there are insufficient funds in the vaults of justice, in the vaults of economic sustenance in this country, that note can't be redeemed and paid in full.
Well, and I'd like to get our other guest and welcome our other guest to also weigh in on this. Ethel Long Scott is Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda, a nonprofit committed to attaining economic human rights for all people. Hi, Ethel. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
How are you reflecting back on Martin Luther King Jr. and to look at the rest of his speech? He said, "We've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice."
Well, I mean, I think that the earlier speaker talked about, couched it in terms of both the historic way that it captured the injustices to that period. And the thing that I'm really struck by in looking at Dr. King is that he continued to grow and evolve as a leader and thinker. And I'm struck by the fact that in the latter years of his life, before he was assassinated, he was working, had made a call for a poor people's campaign. And I mean, the notion that yes, we can get to the, we can have access to the counter, you know, it's integrated, but if you don't have money to purchase the hamburger, then what? And I think this question of the economic security that was evident in his early work, but became much more pronounced, that we needed a transformative movement to get there. Those are things that I have most definitely reflected on. And I reflect on them primarily because so little is frequently said about his latter work. Especially in looking at all of the Occupy, had an occasion to talk to some leaders yesterday. I said, well, frankly, 45 years ago, Resurrection City was set up, a shanty town with canvas and wood and a mule train, and it was to occupy Washington. They didn't call it that, but the effort was to elevate these primary. So I think it's important for many of us to look at the breadth of work and the things left undone.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about that, Clarence. And I know that you're in transit right now. How much longer can you stay with us?
Well, for a few more minutes.
Okay.
I would remind everyone who's listening, including my colleague, the former speaker, Dr. King, I one of the things that somewhat annoys those of us, I can't speak for anyone else, but myself, that annoys me as someone who was close to him and an advisor and a draft speechwriter, is that you know, they celebrate these great lofty concepts, and they are great, about equality and, you know, in the speech. And but they seem to subordinate what was really central to Dr. King's being, and that is his whole question of poverty,
yeah.
His whole question of income inequality. So much so that we spent a considerable time drafting what is called the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged. And the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged was intended to be a proposal for the Johnson administration for them to consider a way of adopting this bill. People want to eulogize and put Dr. King on a pedestal, indeed, as he should be put on a pedestal. But somehow, in my sense, sometimes to sanitize him, when in fact the heart of who this man was, the heart of his legacy, is really his unswerving, unconditional commitment to nonviolence,
mm-hmm.
and his unswerving, unconditional commitment to erase poverty.
Yes,
I mean, poverty was a very central part, and yes, the Poor People's Campaign, although it was not deemed to be a success, it was a reflection of the heart and soul of who this man was.
And Clarence, before we let you go, it seems like, well, there's obviously a major shift in opinion about the income gap. And people are frustrated. They're becoming a lot more aware. These issues are ending up on the front pages. It seems like we're at a tipping point. So how can you turn this awareness and frustration into tangible changes?
Well, I think, I just want to say, because I'm going to have to get off the phone soon. I don't mean to preempt something that takes so much time, but I would think that there is no question that the Occupy Wall Street really is a reflection of the soul and thinking of what Martin King, he would be absolutely appalled at the consequences of income inequality. In fact, that is income inequality and the growing impoverishment of a substantial segment of the American population, not just African Americans, but population in general.
Mm.
And this is and this includes the white people, obviously, women, women who are heads of families, so forth. It's growing, and he would be appalled that the so-called good people, and I include the faith-based community, you know, all these preachers going around preaching the prosperity gospel and all so forth, he'd be appalled at their absolute silence and absolute inaction in dealing with this. It's like Nero fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, the poverty of what's happening to people in America is serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I am particularly harsh critical of these various pastors, of these the faith-based community. They get up Sunday morning and pontificate over this, pontificate over that, and pass the collection plate. They got to deal with the serious issue that people face on a day-to-day lives from in their churches.
Well, Clarence,
and I'm sorry, I don't mean to preach or be so. I apologize for it.
No, there's no need to apologize. You'd be happy to know that a number of black churches over the weekend encouraged their attendees to join various Occupy movements.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I saw that they're going to occupy the offices of 13 branches of the Federal Reserve Bank. I applaud that very strongly.
Yeah, right. Well, Clarence, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I'm in transit, and my apologies. All of those people, like the other people on the show, we those of us who are blessed by longevity to have some degree of survival to be living this long. I just turned 81. I'm blessed, so we welcome all of you who support the legacy and work of Martin King.
Well, we're glad you're still with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and God
Thank
bless you.
You.
Dr. Clarence Jones drafted the I Have a Dream speech and was an attorney for Dr. King. He's author of the book Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. And you can find out more about his work at yourcallradio.org. 81 years old and still going strong. In fact, last night he won an award the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Day Celebration Award at Georgetown University, and still writing, still speaking. He was in transit. That's why his line was bad, so sorry about that. And we are joined by Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, someone who's also still going strong. And we're so grateful for it, Ethel. So I wanted to talk with you, Ethel, about this Pew Research Survey and get your take on what this really tells us about consciousness and what this means for where we're going. 66% of Americans believes there is a very strong conflict between the rich and the poor. And less than 3 years ago, that was about 47%. So this is a big jump. The biggest jump came from whites who call themselves independents. And the increase was also substantial among Republicans, 55% of those polled, up from just 38% last year, even as their party is railing against the concept of class divisions. What does this really tell you?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that's going on. That Pew report is really very, it's exhaustive, it's extensive. And I don't recall if it's in there also that they cite the Census Bureau's recent reports about noting that there's about 146 million Americans who they are now defining as low income. Well, Rose, that's almost half the population.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of ways we talk about that the quote-unquote middle class, it's just middle income workers, is being gutted and lost. And I think that that's what this report, the Pew report, is tracking. But it's also doing it in a very particular way and also demonstrating that more and more wealth is being concentrated in fewer hands. And those hands may be multiracial as a result of the civil rights movement. It's very, very interesting. We, you know, we had, this isn't the world of a pre-1960s and the explosion of the social movement to tear down segregation. We now have each economic class has integrated into their respective classes. And this report really reflects that. So I think that there's a couple of moving pieces that are happening in America. And the fact that we can point to a Jay-Z or a Beyonce or any number of affluent actors, actresses, blah, blah, blah. You're the majority of working folk. Where are we? What is happening to us in the past 40 years, 20 years, 10 years? And I think that we are finding that our lot is becoming profoundly worse and is connected with big structural change.
Mm. Well, and I'd love to get listeners in on this. Obviously, awareness is increasing. So is frustration. So how do you turn this into real policy changes or just changes across the board? Where do you see this going? The number is 866-798-8255. Obviously, this presents an opportunity for people from different backgrounds to come together around common goals, or at least that's the hope. Do you think that this is an opportunity, and what would that look like? 866-798-8255. And then also, what has and has not changed since the I Have a Dream speech in 1963? And how does Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement continue to inspire? There was a couple great photos on the cover of the Chronicle today, or the cover of their local section today, showing children painting at schools and a number of families taking to the streets and marching. People are saying that this is very an inspiring time, and we are at the tipping point. So what does this really mean to you? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you think about that, Ethel? It seems like this is a perfect opportunity to really run with this and tap into this frustration and get people from different walks of life to work together. How do you see this playing out?
Oh, I think that just to echo your earlier speaker and speaking to the importance of the Occupy Wall Street movement and beginning to do a few things. One, just kind of waking up from this slumber that, you know, the big daddy corporations are going to take care of us. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I think that the notion that we have to rely on one another, we have to see the change that we want to happen is going to need to come from we working people crafting that. And what that suggests, Rose, I mean, it seems kind of obvious, but it has not been what the practice has been for 40 years, which has been that we have to be informed by a broader vision, something much beyond our individual heartache and hurt. it's got to inform what we think about as solutions, but we also have to have that critical analysis. And the reality is, I mean, when I look at the racial divisions of the world that I grew up in, and it's so different for you and my grandkids, I'm happy about that. There's something to celebrate. But on the other hand, the economic disparities have really, really deepened. So I think that there's one other thing that I think that Dr. King that I see is different now. In the period of the Civil Rights Movement, a lot of the businesses, they were a part of big government expansion. So they really benefited from the expansion of the Civil Rights Movement. But now, those big corporations are the main ones who are poised to destroy democracy in our country. And every day, there are new threats on a federal, national, and municipality level, a federal, state, and municipality levels. This is a great threat. There's been passage in the Senate of things where somebody like Dr. King, he would have been considered a war combatant.
Mm-hmm.
This is big, and it's additional. It's aimed at making us shut up to the hurt that we're facing. So I think we have to, one, educate ourselves. And I think, yes, you're right, organizations, the last time we saw each other, it was maybe just pre the explosiveness of the Occupy movement. But I think it's really so significant, and we have to continue to build on that.
We're speaking with Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, talking about how far we have or haven't come since Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in 1963. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Ethel, what changes have you seen in your community and the communities you work with over the past few years?
Oh, boy. Well, as you know, I live and work in the city of Oakland, but I work all over the state and different parts of the country, and I've seen that for unemployed poor workers who are becoming increasingly propertyless, an ally, Corinne Kumar, says, you know, in our country we're kind of oftentimes we like to quantify everything in numbers and statistics,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is great numbers of people are not being fed. Great numbers of increasing numbers of people are not only face foreclosure, but they are also they're in dire straits. And of course, they've lost their health care in those situations. So they're, and this goes beyond. I mean, you know, a lot of reports are also indicating that this goes beyond the inner cities. I mean, so in an urban setting like Oakland, even San Francisco, of course, Los Angeles, that's the case. But it's also far more than that. And I think that in the suburbs, the hidden poverty is very real because the loss of jobs. There's an economic transformation that has happened post the Civil War that the powers that be are not talking to regular working people about. And I know your show spends a lot of time delving into and getting into that. We need to really spend time there. We need a new economy to fit the new economic tools roles, and that's what's not being discussed, only subsidizing these corporations.
And you can join us at 866-798-8255. This new Pew poll shows that 66% of Americans believe there's a strong or very strong conflict between the rich and the poor. This is the highest level since Pew began asking the question in 1987. So what does this really tell you about where we are and where we're going? How can various organizations, even Occupy, run with this to create actual change when it comes to the economy and social justice? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show and leave a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will play Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State address, and then we want to hear from you. We'll open the lines to get your take on the state of California, which faces a $9 billion deficit. We will also talk about the latest round of budget cuts. What is your state of the state? That's tomorrow. And then Thursday, we will talk about the state of reproductive rights in the U.S. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what has and has not changed since Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. When you look at the economy and the gap between the rich and the poor, where do you see us today compared to 1963? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what do you make of this Pew poll that shows a growing number of Americans believe there is a very strong conflict between the rich and the poor? There's a huge increase among white independents who now believe this, an increase of almost more than 50%. There's also an increase among Republicans, 55% of those polled, up from 38% in 2009. So what does this really tell you about consciousness in this country? And where does this go from here? The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Sharon in Redwood City. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I was telling your screener that 6 years ago, my daughter, raised in a very liberal household, became anti-affirmative action because of one of her teachers. And it was not until she had a real-life experience that she really got it. She took the most amazing trip in the world her sophomore year. She took a trip called Sojourn to the Past. And they have to study. It's not one of those check-off kind of tourist things. They have to read books by civil rights leaders. They go to the South. They walked across the bridge in Selma with Congressman John Lewis. They went to Central High School with one of Little Rock Nine. It was the most eye-opening trip of her life, and she's completely changed. She gets affirmative action. She started a mentoring program in her high school to bridge the gap between the socioeconomically, academically challenged kids and the kids who are more academically adept. And she's looking at social justice at Pitcher College perhaps next year.
Wow.
It completely changed her.
Interesting. What was there one experience that changed her, or was it just the overall trip?
The man who runs the trip, Jeff Steinberg, really makes sure that the kids know who they're talking to, that they've done research on them, they know about them. And the thing is, when they meet the Little Rock Nine people, these are people who were their age,
right,
who walked into that school. And when they look at that school of 2,000 kids and realize they were one of nine, It just forced them. And I did want to put a plug in because Mr. Steinberg and Minnie Jean Brown Turkey, one of the Little Rock Nine, are actually teaching a class at three local JCs, Skyline, Kenyatta, and I think Foothill, starting this week on landmarks of the Civil Rights Era.
Well, great story. Thank you for calling in, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's go next to Michael in Monterey. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I just had the comment to make. Like, I saw something on The Daily Show the other day, and they were talking about, and Gingrich had said, and it just seems so old-fashioned and racist, is that he was talking about the NAACP, and as he was trying to put himself out there saying, you know, I would be the only Republican candidate that would come down there and show the African-American community what a paycheck is as opposed to a welfare check. And hearing that, I was like, that is inherently racist. And so much that, like, you've done a few shows about Native Americans and the struggles they've had,
right,
and that just sounds to me like when the Protestants came, they were like, we're going to show the natives how to be civilized by killing them all. And that's just inherently racist and ignorant. And it's just like a strain of that kind of human aspect that has kind of allowed itself to survive to today.
You
and
know,
it's somebody who wants to be president.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Ethel, I would love your take on how this rhetoric is still played out today and accepted, and it's sort of turned into more humor on things like The Daily Show. And it's easy to put these on your Facebook page and kind of laugh about them or write them off, but it is really serious. How do you make sense of this?
Well, I think, you know, nothing has worked better in American history than divide and conquer. And I think I take Mr. Gingrich's comments as not only racist, as they are, obviously, but they're also tremendously anti-working class. And one of the key things that something like this does is it really makes it appear that black people haven't worked. I mean, this is so stupid and ahistorical. I mean, and this is for a woman who was touted. It's very, but what does it say to white workers that who is to blame for their unemployment, for their economic hardships? And that is either the black worker who's over there getting a free hand-me-out or the immigrant, any number of people, as opposed to the systemic changes that are reflected here in this system. This is why I think that the importance of the Occupy movement, of establishing the space to really delve into, wait a minute, what are the problems? What's the basis for these problems? And secondly, how do we go about crafting new solutions? I mean, the reality is the robot has replaced tens of millions of jobs, and we're never going to go back to that capitalism from the past period. Most people have a very difficult time getting their brain wrapped around that. That's not a bad thing if we can reshift those tools and resources to benefit educating our people, cleaning up the earth, healing our people. But that really does mean a new economy based on a new social contract. And that is what Mr. Gingrich and the clown of Republicans that are, and I got to throw in some of them Democrats just as bad, because it was the Democratic Congress that just passed this new measure that would classify any dissidents and protests as war combatants. They could disperse the army on us. So these encroachments on freedom and these attacks that divide and conquer, I think that the humor, I love humor, but if they disarm us not to see that the real danger that's there, that to me, that's alarming. So we need to spend the time to see, okay, there's something else that's serious in this message as well. And I think that a lot often in the women's movement, we've had to deal with this in terms of the multiple entendres, double entendres,
yeah,
when you're looking at oppression of women. But we're really looking at oppression and exploitation.
Well, we're talking about that oppression of women on Thursday. Well, thank you for calling in, Michael. And let's go next to Tahir in Sunnyvale. Hi, Tahir. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. It's just a quick comment here about the class race distinction here and how we're being divided. I mean, I'm kind of old now, I guess, and I remember RFK touring the South and meeting with people who were depressed in both Appalachia and elsewhere in Mississippi. And the people who would come out to the door were black sometimes, but they were also white. And if you look at the census reports, as I understand, just this last year, some 60% of the people receiving welfare are white. Hmm. And if we keep talking about it as, you know, a black inner city issue, we are being divided and ignoring the fact that this is much broader and ignores color and goes by class. I mean, that's why Jesse Jackson won Iowa back in 1980. He was talking about pocketbook issues for people who are affected of all colors.
Well, and Tahir, let me ask you, what do you think about this Pew survey that is finding a huge jump among white independents who believe there's a very strong conflict between the rich and the poor? There's also a jump among Republicans. According to a recent Bloomberg Washington Post poll, 53% of Republicans believe taxes should be increased on households making more than $250,000 a year. Oh, did we lose Tahir? Oh, sorry about that. Well, I'd love to hear from others about this. What do you make of the Pew survey? What does this really tell you about where we are now and where we're going? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And now I would like to welcome Amaka Ogbo to the show. Amaka is Ella Baker Center's
Hang up and
Soul of City campaign director. Oh, Amaka, do we have you? Nope. Okay, we'll have to reconnect with Amaka. Well, let's go to another caller and then reconnect. Let's hear from Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great show. I'm just concerned to how long they're going to let you be democratic and speak. A Pew survey, it's very difficult even to deny reality considering how much ideology you have. That's what my comment. I just want to remind people of a rather dry academic truth, but a driving factor that maybe 5 to 10%, the upper 5-10% of the 95%, the 99% are working very hard every day to make the maximum profits for the 1% at the expense of the 99%. And these people are very intelligent and very well paid and very motivated, and they have families to support, and there's nothing personal, and they're doing their job, and they're technologists as I am myself, and I know these people, and that's just the fact.
Well, and thank you for calling in. What do you make of this Pew report? How significant do you think it is?
Oh, very significant. But, you know, reality is undeniable. Eventually, it creeps into any kind of ideology. That's what I make of it.
Yeah.
You can't deny reality forever.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in,
sure.
Ed. And I believe that Amaka is back. Amaka Ogbo is Ella Baker Center's Soul of City campaign director. Amaka, are you with us?
I am. Sorry about that.
Oh, great. No, that's fine. Thank you for joining us. So, Amaka, why don't you talk a little bit about the legacy of Dr. King and the civil rights movement for your generation?
Sure. I think it's actually really interesting to be able to reflect on that, given everything that's happening in the world right now. The population that I work with at the Ella Baker Center is what we call young adults. So people young, early 20s to mid-30s. And what we've found is that, just like during the civil rights movement, is that people around that age are extremely interested and energetic and want to get involved and get engaged in their community and are just trying to figure out how to best do that. And so, like, when the young people are starting to sit down at the counters, we see that the young people are starting to step up and occupy their cities. And so being able to see that connection in which the role of young adults being able to be that pinnacle point in a movement in which everything starts to shift and we can start to see some real outcomes and wins for our community, and it's extremely inspiring.
And how do young people talk about economic justice and the income gap? What do those conversations sound like?
Yeah, well, I think the conversation on economic justice and the income gap, part of it depends on where you're coming from. You know, especially as your own class and your own access to wealth. I think for some communities, low-income communities, those conversations have been around the need to get food on the table and pay the energy bill. I think for other folks, you know, middle-class, working-class folks, those conversations are watching the scholarships get cut, watching financial aid start to get cut, and people starting to struggle and being able to go to school. And so especially for those folks who may be the first in their family, the first in their generation to be able to go to the University of California school system or even go to the state's college system in California, when you can no longer pay your bills and pay your tuition, that the economic justice issue becomes very real in another way, in which first it was about getting food on the table, and now it's about being able to get the education that you need.
And according to the latest census numbers, white Americans have an average of 20 times the net worth of African Americans and 18 times that of Latinos. And so when you talk about, you know, where this is going in the future, and there's so much more awareness, these issues are now on the front pages. In fact, the Republicans are using some of this language, you know, calling people like Mitt Romney a vulture capitalist. How do you really use this or take this momentum and use it to really make some changes?
Well, Rose, may I speak to that?
Sure, Ethel.
One of the things that we really see trying to do from this is we had already been mobilizing for something called the World Courts of Women on Poverty in the U.S., and we're really proud to be hosting that in the spring of this year. And really it's an extension of both the World Social Forum's efforts as well as, of course, the Occupy, of occupying space to elevate both the problems and our solutions, because the solutions have got to be how do we increase the life of all of us, not just the ones and twos, not just how many can we beg as a patronage system, of the past era used to provide for a certain percentage. It was a tattered safety net, and now it's being destroyed. That we, in fact, need to use that momentum to bring together people from every walk of life to contemplate, okay, so what is the economy that we need that sustains and cares for this planet and also cares for the other living creatures in it? But that means it needs to come from us. And we need to be informed that the reason something like a Defense Authorization Act can pass in the Senate is that a good deal of the Senate, almost 56% of them, are millionaires, and they're part of the 1%. Mm. And another 46% of House representatives are millionaires, and are a fat cat like Daryl Isaacs is amongst one of the wealthiest. His net worth is at $303 million. We are going to have to figure out that we need every space possible, and these young people are fundamental in this, to talk about crafting new visions forward for what justice really looks like that does not embrace oppression and exploitation.
And Amaka, what would you add to that?
Yeah, so to build off of what she just said, I think something that's extremely interesting is, in addition to what's happening on the national level, what the Occupy movement has shown us is that all these different encampments are place-based. They have a relationship to the city and the community in which they occupy. And so in addition to being able to have people look at what's happening on the federal level, being able to take a lot of that energy that our young people are showing, and this is what we've seen in Oakland with our Soul the City membership, our young people are really interested about figuring out, so we did the Occupy thing. Now what's the next step? And our membership is having intense conversations around what are the solutions for Oakland's 99%, and how do we start the conversation there? How do we start to talk about how the foreclosure crisis impacts people's ability to get the jobs they need? As also we see coming up in 2012 elections, impacts the ability for low-income people and communities of color that have been displaced to even be able to vote and engage in this election cycle. And so our young people are starting to connect the dots. And I just think it's extremely interesting when young people are able to connect those dots, and then they have the momentum and that energy to move it forward and start pushing for those policies, and start pushing for those changes that actually create real wins and real outcomes for the communities that desperately need them.
Amaka Agbo is with the Ella Baker Center's Soul of City campaign, and Ethel Long Scott is executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And we have just under 10 minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in on this and talk about, obviously, the solutions and where we are 44 years after Martin Luther King was assassinated, when it comes to economic justice, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And just to spend a little bit of time on Occupy, Amaka, the Chronicle had an interesting story yesterday about black pastors urging their followers to join Occupy. And the Reverend Harold Mayberry, he's with the First African Methodist Episcopal Church over in Oakland. He said that there's been some challenges because he doesn't really have many ties to the Occupy movement. And I was just really interested in some of the sentiments by a number of the people that go to his church saying, well, we really didn't know what it was about. We weren't sure what their goals were. But now that you let us know that it's kind of okay to join, we might actually get involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Occupy movement is extremely interesting for communities that have been watching and experiencing economic injustice for decades. And so for them, it's not new to not be able to get a job. For them, it's not new to not be able to pay their energy bill. Yeah. And so when we have a conversation around who can even occupy, a lot of people in the black churches, the reality is that if you are on parole, if you are just coming home from the prison system, you actually can't risk being caught up in the sweeping up of police closing down the tents. If you're undocumented, you actually can't risk that. And so being able to have that conversation on the privilege of being able to occupy, I think it's a great opportunity to build those bridges for these communities, for the African-American community, the Latino community, to figure out how do we now lead this movement. So we're talking about the solutions for our communities as well. I think something that's really interesting that's happening down in Alabama is also passing their hateful anti-immigration law. A lot of the black churches have been able to come together and build solidarity for the undocumented community in Alabama as a way of showing that what was once an attack on the rights of African Americans under Jim Crow, under slavery, is now an attack on Latinos. And so if you go after them, you're coming after us. Yes. And so being able to have communities come together and build those unique bridges. And so we don't want to split up the Occupy movement. That's not going to help anyone. If we can figure out how to come together under common needs and really move it forward in a solutions-oriented manner, I think we can have some great things happening, and I think it's already starting to happen.
Almaka, just on that note, which is really so important, April 5th through 8th, the World Courts of Women on Poverty in the U.S., in the Western region, will be taking up some of those, like about five roundtables, besides collecting testimony, which I hope that Ella Baker will help to contribute to, since this event will be here in Oakland. But we'll be also talking about property rights, women's rights, workers' rights will be run roundtable, the economy, why is there poverty, and how it intersects with all the other issues, health care for the 99%, oppression and violence and women's actions and the need for healing. I think we're trying to build on the momentum and the sensibilities of the Occupy movement and more deliberately bring together communities in a space to talk about both the critical analysis of capitalism, and I think we've got to say it, I mean, because that's part of what we're talking about, and globalization, and then what's the way forward, not simply reacting, because I think that many of us work in economic justice, we work on that 24/7, but what the civil rights movement of Dr. King's era, and for instance, the Poor People's Campaign, and what the Occupy movement of this era, the connection is that they are both about a bigger vision that's both talking about democracy as well as ending exploitation. Because certainly at the end of his, in the latter part of his life, he began to write more forcefully about the question of economic security being at the base of moving our work forward. So I hope that this will be an opportunity for us to link arms and put gray matter together to elevate this to another level.
And what do you think about the racial makeup of the future and what this tells us about where we're going? United for a Fair Economy just released a report called State of the Dream 2012, The Emerging Majority. And they looked at the racial economic divide since the election of Reagan in 1980. And they said the past 30 years of public policy has done little to address racial economic disparities. They say the racial economic divide is a national embarrassment. Eliminating it should be a moral imperative, and as the non-white share of the population grows, it will become an increasingly urgent economic necessity. What they found is fascinating. Half of today's U.S. residents under 18 are of color, that's half, while 80% of retirees are white. And they find that by 2030, the majority of U.S. residents under 18 will be youth of color. By 2042, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, and Pacific Islanders and other non-whites will collectively compose the majority of the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does this tell you, Ethel?
Well, I think that as we've been speaking today about the interrelationship of race and class, that, you know, it's not one or the other in American history. And I think that that's what that says to me, is that the numbers, our integration is real. We're human beings, and that's going to happen. But will the political, will those simple numbers erase our political inequity? So in other words, we can't, you know, you can't do a pass a law, because we've had lots of laws, to deal with political inequities. We've got to get economic independence and political independence together. And that's what that report suggests to me, that needs to be right up at the top of our agenda. And that, of course, is why one of the things we'll be talking about at the Courts of Women is the abolishment of poverty, being we need to make that a higher explicit part of the agenda. And that goes across class lines. And I think that was one of the things that Dr. King's work was working across color lines. I'm sorry, I said across class lines, but I meant across color lines. I think the more we can grab that and pull that, the stronger our work will be going forward.
We have an email from Paul who says, what I find deeply unsettling is that MLK was killed just as his message was developing from civil rights to peace, social justice, and poverty.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's when it got dangerous, right? When people started to connect the fact that, oh, it's not just black people who are struggling to eat and feed their families. It's also poor white folks as well. And then those bridges are starting to form together. People couldn't have that. So they had to go get him. I think when you first started saying the numbers as far as the shifting landscape of the U.S. demographics, you started talking about voters during Reagan's election. And something we work on heavily is to turn out unlikely and occasional and never voters, because what we're seeing is that the electorate, especially in Oakland, is shrinking and shrinking. And so those people who are voting and shaping making the decisions that shape the lives of people living in Deep East and West Oakland are not those that are voting. And if we can turn, we've seen that when we turn our folks out to the polls, we can actually shift the outcomes of elections. And so as we're seeing how the U.S. is starting to shift, we also need to start sharing with our communities the culture of engaging in the voting process. Even if there are candidates we don't necessarily support, there are issues that we should always be engaging in, and to start having that at the center of how our young people are engaging.
And let me ask you, we just have about 30 seconds, because we really want to focus on solutions in 2012. Ethelong Scott, if there was a policy change you could make tomorrow, what would it be?
That would be to do everything we can to abolish poverty and deny corporations personhood.
And what about you, Amaka?
I would work to give formerly incarcerated people the right to vote and shut down the prison system.
All right, Amaka Ogbo is Ella Baker Center's Soul of City campaign director, and Ethelong Scott is executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How will Governor Jerry Brown's budget plan affect California this year? On the next Your Call, we'll air Governor Brown's State of the State address, and then we want to hear from you. What's your take on the state of California, which faces a $9 billion deficit? The governor is hoping to raise revenue through tax increases on the November ballot. The question is, will it pass? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What's your state of the state? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.